Hello and welcome. I am Dr. Phyllis Lee. On behalf of CME Outfitters, I would like to welcome you and thank you for joining us today's CMEO briefcase entitled Choosing and Optimizing Therapy in Narcolepsy. This program is supported by an independent medical education grant from Jazz Pharmaceuticals. A little bit more about me. I am also the director of the Center for Circadian and Sleep Medicine and Chief of Sleep Medicine in the Department of Neurology at Northwestern University Feinberg School of Medicine. I'm really delighted to be joined today by my distinguished colleagues, Dr. Carl DeGrangi, Dr. Paul DeGrangi, and Julie Fleiger. Please introduce yourselves.
Hello, I'm Carl DeGrangi, and I'm professor of psychiatry with secondary appointments in neurology and medicine at Sidney Kimmel Medical College of Thomas Jefferson University. I'm also medical director of the Jefferson Sleep Disorder Center and also direct the fellowship program at Thomas Jefferson University. Good to be with you.
Hello, I'm Dr. Paul DeGrangi. I am senior family physician at Collegeville Family Practice in Collegeville, Pennsylvania, and also medical director of health services at Ursinus College, also in Collegeville, Pennsylvania.
Hi there, I'm Julie Fleiger, and I'm the president and CEO of Project Sleep and the author of Wide Awake and Dreaming, a Memoir of Narcolepsy, and I'm based in Los Angeles.
Thank you so much for your introductions. So as we are all really beginning to recognize that patients with narcolepsy have a multitude of comorbidities, and more recently, the recognition of the cardiovascular comorbidity. So therefore, it is really important and timely that we're having this discussion. Our learning objective for today is to initiate or, where appropriate, to switch treatment plans for our patients with narcolepsy that, in consideration of the higher risk for cardiovascular comorbidities, and this would include changes perhaps in dosing and also titration strategies. Now let's take a look at our patient, Jennifer. She is a 26-year-old Hispanic female who presents for results of her sleep study. She was diagnosed with narcolepsy type 1, that includes with cataplexy. Her previous medical history includes obesity, depression, hypertension, family history of obesity, cardiovascular disease. Her father had both hypertension and a history of a myocardial infarction. Social history is notable for that she works as an internal designer, but struggles with deadlines due to complaints of tiredness. She has difficulty getting out of bed in the morning, has attempted to diet, exercise, but again, is frequently way too tired to make meals and even go to the gym. She lives alone, but has a boyfriend who has been very helpful. Her BMI is 33, so that's elevated. Blood pressure is elevated, 36 over 89, and also elevated PHQ-9. Medications include venlafaxine, 75 milligrams daily, lisinopril, 5 milligrams daily, and a hormonal birth control treatment. So we're going to discuss about her treatment and some of our thoughts about our patient. And I'd like to ask our panel as to, what do you think about this patient? Give a perspective on what you're thinking about her, this patient's experiences, and how you would consider further evaluation and or treatment strategies. So, Julie, what do you think about this patient?
Yeah, I just think this is a really difficult position to be in, to be 26 years old and just receiving a type 1 narcolepsy with cataplexy diagnosis, in addition to having other things going on. I just can't help but stress enough how having narcolepsy come into your life is very unwelcome for anyone. Yes, I'm sure, I imagine this person would be relieved to get a diagnosis finally, but then tackling treatment and trying to find the right dosage and the right medications, this is a really overwhelming position to be in. And it can take a lot of time, a lot of patience, a lot of tweaking to probably optimize treatment for this person. I can just imagine being really overwhelmed at the beginning. So, you know, it would probably be a journey to find the right optimized treatment.
Thank you. So, you know, as we can see, you know, from her history, she has, you know, multiple comorbidities, not only cardiovascular comorbidities, but, you know, there's been a recent study called the BOND study, where really identify that patients with narcolepsy have many comorbidities from other sleep disorders, mental health issues, as well as physical conditions. So, Paul, do you want to tell us a little bit more about these kind of medical and psychiatric comorbidities in our patients with narcolepsy?
Sure. Now, in primary care, to those of you out there who are in primary care, you're going to see patients with narcolepsy. But one of the things that you always have to consider in these patients is comorbidities. As you can see here with the BOND study, there is the odds ratios of having mood disorders, depressive disorders, and we saw in our case presentation, this woman does have major depressive disorder. Anxiety disorders is significantly elevated. And other comorbidities, by the way, medical ones like obstructive sleep apnea and obesity. And sometimes it's going to be a little bit challenging. And I think it can be challenging even to the sleep center where they're doing a sleep study, a daytime and a nighttime study. They'll find obstructive sleep apnea, and they might also even find a narcolepsy. So in your patients that have narcolepsy, we have to be on the lookout for these possibilities. One other way that I'd also like to twist it and say this, in patients that do have mood disorders in your practice or have depressive disorders or anxiety or sleep apnea or obesity, who are tired, look for the possibility that they could have narcolepsy. So you want to also think about it in that way as well.
So it's more than, you know, we can think of it as sleepiness, right? And maybe cataplexy, but all of these other comorbidities really affect not just the quality of our page of their lives, but also I think maybe as we think about optimizing treatment for these patients. So do you want to, Paul, discuss a little bit about specifically the cardiovascular disease risk in these patients?
Yeah, and I think that this is really surprising and eye-opening, and it's something that we need to take into careful consideration. What we see here on this slide is the cardiovascular burden of narcolepsy that was seen in this BOND study, which is a real-world evidence study. And the key findings were that those with narcolepsy are at increased risk of developing new-onset cardiovascular events compared to those that don't have narcolepsy. And therefore, you should consider these conditions possibly occurring. As you can see on the very bottom on the bar graph there, stroke, atrial fibrillation, cardiovascular disease, not including hypertension, major adverse cardiovascular events, heart failure, atrial fibrillation again, stroke, ischemic stroke, all at greater risk in patients with narcolepsy compared with those who don't have narcolepsy. So we have to be on the lookout. And this is very common that we do in primary care, where we see patients with one condition and we have to be on the lookout for other conditions that could occur at the same time and do something about it, either to test for it or to reduce the risks of developing those conditions. On the right-hand side there also, you can see, again, ischemic stroke, 67% greater, heart failure, 35% greater, cardiovascular disease, 30% greater, stroke, AFib or edema, 48%, MACE, 45%, stroke, 71%. So you can see that there's a much higher risk of cardiovascular disease. On the right-hand side there, don't forget, hypertension, diabetes, and hypercholesterolemia, all at greater risk in these patients with narcolepsy. Once again, in patients who have these cardiovascular disease, also make sure that if they have tiredness, excessive daytime sleepiness, look for the possibility that they could also have narcolepsy. So it kind of goes both ways. Yes, those who have narcolepsy, we're looking for these cardiovascular events and trying to prevent them from occurring, but also patients who have these conditions, look for the possibility that they might have narcolepsy.
Yeah, it's really eye-opening. I think especially this new, recent, really right off the press study showing that it isn't just an increased risk, but it actually patients with narcolepsy, if you follow them for years, they have an increased incidence of cardiovascular disease. So it's really, and because narcolepsy, as you all know, is a chronic condition, identifying these cardiovascular disease risks early and mitigating some of those early in life appears to be probably really, really important. So now let's give the audience a chance to participate by introducing an audience response question. Based on the questions you probably gather, there are many treatments for excessive daytime sleepiness as well as for cataplexy in patients with narcolepsy. Some of them have an impact on cardiovascular system more than others. So it is important to consider them when treating our patients with cardiovascular issues and also those who may not have cardiovascular issues but are likely to be at higher risk. One of the oldest treatments that all of us have been, using is that of stimulant medications. So Dr. Carl DeGramji, what can you tell us about them?
So stimulants indeed have been a major aspect of the treatment of narcolepsy traditionally. We've seen the introduction of a lot of newer agents, in which we'll be going over in a few minutes. But the only approved stimulants for the treatment of narcolepsy are amphetamine and dextroamphetamine combination and methylphenidate. You see the doses on the right side of the slide. With dextroamphetamine, the ages dictate to some extent the dosages, but 10 milligram increments in dose raise until a maximum of 50 or so, 60 milligrams are reached. With dextroamphetamine. With methylphenidate, 5 milligram dose increments are probably a bit better until roughly the same dosage levels are reached. Amphetamines are probably effective and helpful as PRN medications, as needed medications in many narcoleptics, once they have an all-day drug on board, such as modafinil and other medications. They are less likely used as sole agents for narcolepsy. We see the mechanism of action of these agents. Basically, they are enhanced neurotransmission of dopamine and norepinephrine. Interestingly, data on the efficacy of these compounds are somewhat limited. The studies have not been done with the methodological rigor that we see with the more recent agents, but meta-analytic data indicate that they reduce Epworth sleepiness scale scores by an order of about 3 points or so, which is a modest yet significant level of increase in sleepiness levels. Now, the major side effects of these agents include things like cardio acceleration, which is important for our purpose of our discussion here. They also can produce blood pressure increases, although these effects are somewhat limited and modest, on the order of maybe 1 or 5 or 6 points of increase in blood pressure. Nevertheless, it's a good idea to be a bit cautious in patients who have arrhythmias or underlying cardiovascular abnormalities. The package inserts for stimulant drugs warn against use of them in patients with pre-existing heart conditions or structural abnormalities of the heart due to the possibility of sudden death and stroke and myocardial infarction. The question of sudden death has been evaluated in a number of different studies, and the data are really quite controversial in this regard. But because of that possibility, I think it's a good idea to be cautious. And many physicians recommend doing an electrocardiogram before instituting treatment to make sure about cardiac safety. There's interesting no increase or change in the QT interval with these drugs in retrospective studies. Other side effects for these drugs include nervousness, nausea, some sleep disruption or insomnia if they're given too close to bedtime. They may reduce appetite. We have to be careful in patients with psychiatric disturbances because of the possibility of psychosis and mania. So patients with uncontrolled psychiatric disturbances, I think, need to be a bit careful here. They may also disrupt growth.
While, not really used for excessive daytime sleepiness, venlafaxine is commonly used for the treatment of cataplexy in our patients, especially such as our patient with type 1 narcolepsy. So, Carl, what can you tell us about venlafaxine?
Venlafaxine, of course, is an antidepressant, and antidepressants at low doses have been traditionally used for the treatment of cataplexy and some of the REM symptoms, such as hypnagogic hallucinations and sleep paralysis, although the data on these are not well gathered in the same methodological rigor that we would see in the more recent drugs introduced for narcolepsy. Nevertheless, they're quite commonly used for that purpose. And the dosages are not really the high doses we see with that we would use for the treatment of depression, but they're a bit lower, and that these doses, low doses, we would not expect them necessarily to be great antidepressants. In the past, we saw the use of tricyclic antidepressants for this purpose because of their monoamine neurotransmission. They tend to block levels of REM sleep and some of the REM aspects of narcolepsy, which are useful clinically. The problem with the tricyclics, of course, has been the fact that they have some cardiac potential that's negative, and also their anticholinergic side effects may produce unusual side effects such as dry mouth, sweating, constipation, and tachycardia. The SSRIs are a major advance in this regard, and we've seen the use of things like fluoxetine and paroxetine for narcolepsy, control of cataplexy. Those drugs, unfortunately, also can produce some sedation, which is a major limitation factor, which is something you really don't want to see, of course, for narcolepsy. The SNRIs, the serotonin norepinephrine reuptake inhibitors, such as venlafaxine and duloxetine, are much more useful in this regard because they have less of a sedating potential. Efficacy has been quite good. Venlafaxine, unfortunately, can also produce sustained hypertension. So we have to be a bit careful, and I would recommend monitoring blood pressure if you are going to be using venlafaxine. Both systolic and diastolic blood pressures can increase. The SNRIs and SSRIs are also category C drugs. They may induce some things called REM behavior disorder, or unusual movements or unusual activity during sleep, I should say, characterized by reaction to dreaming, which is actually behavioral in nature. Not very common, but this can happen, so it's a good idea to watch out for those.
Well, we know that depression is very common in patients with narcolepsy, so venlafaxine and other antidepressants are probably commonly used in patients with narcolepsy for depression, but also, of course, to treat cataplexy. Another classic treatment for narcolepsy is modafinil, which has been used for a long time and still widely used today. Carl, tell us a little bit more about this treatment.
Modafinil and armodafinil, the first wake-promoting agents introduced for the treatment of narcolepsy. Actually, these are indicated for the treatment of excessive sleepiness in narcolepsy and in adults only, not in pediatric patients. The mechanism of action of these drugs is unclear, but they may act through enhancing dopaminergic neurotransmission. The DEA schedule of four agents, so there's some potential for addiction with these drugs, although it's not been a big problem heretofore. The dosages have been described for you on the slide with modafinil, 200 to 400 milligram doses once a day in the morning. Some people like to split dose, give the first dose in the morning and a second dose at noontime, but no after, but you should not be given afternoon because they may produce some degree of sleep disruption. Armodafinil, 150 to 250 milligrams once in the morning, usually. Meta-analytic data have shown that these agents also decrease sleepiness effectively, decrease in Epworth sleepiness scale scores on the order of about 3 points, which is significant, modest, but clearly significant. The common side effects with these agents are what you would anticipate: headache, nausea, some dizziness, possibly insomnia, especially if given too late into the evening, anxiety production. They're slight inducers of the CYP2C19 system and also the CYP3A45 system. So they may decrease the effect of the serum concentrations of steroidal contraceptives. So for that reason, if patients are on these contraceptives, you have to warn them that they may actually reduce the effectiveness of contraceptives, and they should really be using ancillary additional methods of birth control. They may require more frequent monitoring of prothrombin times and INR times, especially when co-administered with warfarin. There's also the rare possibility of a serious side effect called Stevens-Johnson syndrome. This is an allergic response, which is characterized, of course, as you know, by a skin rash, which may get quite extensive and could be even life-threatening. Very rare, but nevertheless, patients should be warned that if they do develop a rash, which is unusual, they should tell the clinician and immediately stop taking the drug and not be re-challenged with the agent if, in fact, they have proven to have Stevens-Johnson. From a cardiovascular standpoint, there's a very modest but slight potential for increased blood pressure and heart rate. Certainly, if patients have unstable cardiovascular disease, these should be avoided. They should be cautious. And they may also, you may also want to monitor blood pressure, especially in patients who are prone to hypertension, as I said, or blood pressure that's not well controlled.
What are the challenges for patients who are on oral contraception is that modafinil may decrease the effectiveness of birth control medication. So I kind of want to open up to the panel, Paul or Julie. What are your thoughts about that and your own experience?
Yeah, I mean, I just think it's really important that there are so many different treatment options. I think that's a really great benefit to the narcolepsy space right now, that we have more treatment options. Every single person's experience will be different with all these different options. And so there's no, you know, that's why I think of treatment as a journey, because there's never going to be one exact treatment plan that's going to work for everyone. It's always going to be an individualized process, and how each of these treatments impacts very important things like birth control for some people, or, you know, side effects of certain medications can be really challenging. So from my perspective, the more options, the better, so that you can hopefully find something that works best for you.
And Paul, do you advise your patients who are on modafinil or are modafinil about this issue?
Yeah, it does come up, obviously, patients who have narcolepsy, where we want to give them a wake-promoting medication such as modafinil or armodafinil, and they are on birth control. And if they are on the estrogen types like ethinyl estradiol, then we have a dilemma. Either we have to not give them modafinil or armodafinil, or we have to change the birth control from an ethinyl estradiol-containing substance to something else, like maybe one that's primarily only progesterone. So it does pose a dilemma, and that dilemma has to be solved. Oftentimes, we'll prescribe something other than modafinil or armodafinil, fortunately, there are other options.
Yeah, such as like barrier methods. I usually tell my patients, advise them that maybe that would be also a consideration, because sometimes it does really work and patients don't want to get off of it. Another wake-promoting agent that has been recently been approved is solriamfetol. Carl, what can you tell us about solriamfetol?
Solriamfetol is indicated for the treatment of excessive sleepiness in narcolepsy in adults, and also, of course, for obstructive apnea sleepiness. It's not indicated for pediatric patients. It's an all-day drug, given once in the morning, 75 milligrams usually, once daily. Its effects should last pretty much all day, and the dose can be increased up to 150 milligrams. The drug is a probable of dopamine and norepinephrine reuptake inhibitor, a DNRI, and the meta-analytic data show that it also is effective in reducing sleepiness, and Epworth sleepiness scale scores have been reduced on the order of 5 points or so. No comparative data with modafinil, but it's the suggestion of the data indicate that it's probably a bit more potent than modafinil, although, again, as I said, no direct comparative data. The most common side effects of this medication are headache, nausea, some decrease in appetite may occur, insomnia, obviously, and anxiety, which you would anticipate. It's contraindicated with monoamine oxidase inhibitors, and it's metabolized or excreted renally. So we have to be careful in patients who have renal disease. Certainly should not be administered for patients with severe renal impairment, end-stage renal disease, and dose adjustments need to be made for patients with mild to moderate renal disease. This agent can increase blood pressure and can increase heart rate. So you have to be a bit careful with patients who have unstable heart disease, high blood pressure. In any patient, I would recommend monitoring blood pressure for on a regular basis when you start this agent, even if they have no history of heart disease or blood pressure increase. And I do that routinely with my patients just to make sure they don't develop unusual blood pressure abnormalities. Also, serious heart disease is a contraindication to the use of this agent.
Sodium oxybate is a treatment approved for both excessive daytime sleepiness and cataplexy and may contribute because of its higher sodium content to increased cardiovascular disease risk. Carl, can you tell us a little bit more about sodium oxybate?
Sodium oxybate is an agent which is indicated for daytime sleepiness and for cataplexy in patients with narcolepsy above the age of 7. There are two formulations. One is a dual nightly administration agent, the traditional sodium oxybate in liquid form. So patients take at the beginning of the night when they go to bed, and then they wake up 2 or 3 hours later, take the second dose, and they have to be in bed for a minimum of 4 hours after taking the second dose because there's a possibility of daytime grogginess and the sedation, motor impairment, and so on if they take it too late into the night. There's also a more recently introduced once nightly formulation of sodium oxybate that's given, as I said, only once at nighttime when patients go to bed. That's initiated at 4.5 grams nightly, and there's a titration by 1.5 grams nightly in 1 week increments until a maximum of 6 or 9 grams are reached. The maximum for both of these drugs is 9 grams given at bedtime or dual dosing bedtime in the middle of the night. The mechanism of this medication is unclear, but it's thought to act by enhancing GABA-B receptor activity. It's also a DEA Schedule 3 agent, so there's a chance of abuse or misuse. It should be taken on an empty stomach to enhance the efficacy of the drug, so people shouldn't have anything to eat within maybe 3 or 4 hours of taking the medication. The main side effects of the two formulations of sodium oxybate are some respiratory sedation. We have to be careful because of the potent respiratory suppression for these agents that's possible with patients, especially who have obstructive apnea, COPD, or underlying pulmonary conditions. Those should be treated effectively before we start this medication. It can also cause enuresis, especially in patients who've had a history of enuresis, parasomnias, things like sleepwalking and so on. And the reason might be that it increases levels of slow wave or deep sleep. And these parasomnias and enuretic episodes seem to be more common in slow wave sleep episodes during the night. Of concern to us here is that both of these agents have a significant amount of sodium and carry a sodium burden. And you see the high sodium content noted on the slide. The 9-gram dose has 1,640 milligrams of sodium in it. So patients, especially if high blood pressure, cardiac disease, and so on, we should be careful with them because of the potential for increasing blood pressure over time, especially patients with chronic kidney disease also. We may need to be careful because of the potential for enhancing kidney abnormalities. Other side effects include weight loss as I mentioned before, enhancement of respiratory suppression in patients with obstructive sleep apnea.
Paul, what do you think about sodium oxybate? How do you think that the higher sodium, content may affect your patients, and what's your advice for your patients?
Well, in primary care, we have tremendous amount of patients with cardiovascular disease, including hypertension, and we're always counseling them about their sodium intake, as well as, of course, their other dietary issues and lifestyle habits, but especially sodium. So it is concerning that sodium oxybate has a very high sodium content. And we have to advise our patients about that and monitor their blood pressures carefully when they are on such a medication.
So we've had a lot of discussion about treatments that have a potential for cardiovascular impact. But what about some of the medications that are more neutral with regards to cardiovascular effect. Carl, can you discuss one of these medications, pitolisant, with us?
So let's talk a little bit about pitolisant. Pitolisant is an H3 antagonist and inverse agonist. So essentially, it enhances histaminergic neurotransmission. Histamine, as many of you recall, is one of the neurotransmitters which is responsible for wakefulness, much like dopamine, norepinephrine, and serotonin, and acetylcholine. It's interesting that this is the only agent that's DEA unscheduled for the treatment of excessive sleepiness and narcolepsy. Pitolisant is also useful for cataplexy in adults and is indicated for that as well. Meta-analytic data show that it reduces Epworth sleepiness scale scores by the order of about 2 points. Again, similar in terms of efficacy with modafinil and armodafinil, although again, no direct comparative data when it comes to those two agents. Dose ranges are indicated on the right side of the slide. Week one, start with 8.9 milligrams once daily and increase gradually up to a maximum of 35.6 milligrams. Have to be a bit careful with patients with moderate hepatic impairment because it's metabolized by the liver. And in patients with moderate or severe renal impairment, it's not recommended in patients with end-stage renal disease. Now, pitolisant does not increase blood pressure or heart rate, which is a good thing. Unlike many of the agents we've been talking about so far, it does not have a burden in terms of heart rate or a blood pressure increase. However, it does prolong the QT interval. And as many of you know, QT interval enhancement can be a premonitor for patients who may later develop cardiac arrhythmias. So it puts them at risk for cardiac arrhythmias. This is especially true if it's administered with other agents that also enhance the QT segment or interval. So it's a good idea to do an interaction check with the pitolisant and the other agents that you're administering to see if you are going to be increasing the QT interval. I would recommend getting an EKG at baseline to make sure, and maybe getting an EKG after five or so doses of the medication to be on the safe side. You also should be monitoring patients more carefully if they do have renal or hepatic disease, because those types of conditions increase the potential for QT interval prolongation. The adverse events of this agent include things like insomnia, nausea, anxiety, similar to other stimulants or other wake-promoting agents, which we've been talking about so far. Also, like modafinil, armodafinil, it may reduce the effectiveness of oral contraceptives. So you have to ask patients to use alternative methods of birth control if they're going to be on this medication.
And Paul, do you use pitolisant? And if so, within what context?
Yeah, I do have a certain amount of patients that are taking pitolisant, whether I've prescribed them or I've sent them to a sleep center and they've come back on the medication. Fortunately, this medication doesn't have nearly the cardiovascular impact that other medications can have, so I feel a bit better about that. But nonetheless, when patients come to my office in primary care, we're always checking their cardiovascular status, including their blood pressure. And we fortunately do find that pitolisant doesn't seem to have that much of an effect on their blood pressure.
Lastly, we have a lower sodium oxybate, which also has been recently approved. So, Carl, what can you tell us a little bit about the lower sodium formulation of sodium oxybate?
So low dose or lower dose sodium oxybate, this is an agent very similar to sodium oxybate, but the cation or the positive ion has been replaced or has been largely replaced from sodium to include potassium, calcium, and magnesium. So there's a reduction in the sodium burden compared to sodium oxybate for this medication. All of the dosing strategies and side effects are pretty much the same with this medication as they are with sodium oxybate, with the only exception that there is no increase in blood pressure or heart rate, and there is no sodium burden in the long run in terms of cardiovascular disease and in terms of renal disease. So there is a safety profile for this agent. You know, the American Heart Association, as many of you know, has recommended a total daily sodium intake of less than 1,500 milligrams and 2300 milligrams being the upper limit to maintain blood pressure and heart health. And the reduction of the sodium amounts in sodium oxybate to this medication certainly are consistent with those health recommendations of the American Heart Association.
Paul, any other thoughts about?
Well, it's low sodium and it's oxybate, so it poses a better choice, better alternative, especially considering everything that we've said so far, which is that patients with narcolepsy have a higher incidence of cardiovascular disease, and we want to keep their sodium intake low. So it stands to reason that when we're going to be prescribing sodium oxybate, that we would probably want to drift over to the low sodium oxybate.
Yeah, and the American Heart Association recommends, right, for a healthy cardiovascular health to decrease and or at least during control our sodium intake. So it looks to me like a win-win situation as well. Let's now give the audience another chance to participate with another audience response question. So these are great answers. It is clear that we need to be mindful of cardiovascular health with our patients with narcolepsy. We have here some of the cardiovascular risk factors that we can modify. And many of these are behavioral, some of those are environmental, such as smoking, physical activity, weight management, diet, and as we mentioned earlier, sodium intake. And also, very importantly, healthy sleep. I think it was a major win for our field, and Paul, you can chime in on this, when the American Heart Association went from the essential, seven to the eight now, which includes for healthy heart, includes better sleep and better sleep health.
So it's very important for us to know and pass on to our patients the important aspects of cardiovascular health. We see patients all the time. We follow them in the office for years and years. We do complete checkups on them, and we counsel them. What are the important things so that you will stay heart healthy? And there are eight of them, as for the American Heart Association, that they've come up with. Six of them are on this slide here. So smoking cessation is very important. Physical activity, and there's specific guidelines on that. Weight loss, keeping your BMI down. Diet, and oftentimes referring to a Mediterranean diet. Lowering sodium intake, especially in patients with hypertension and congestive heart failure, and healthy sleep. It's so good that they put this one in there as part of the eight different factors. Now, the other two factors that are not on this slide are cholesterol and blood sugar management, but not, needless to say, it's so important for us to pass on to our patients the importance of good sleep when we want to ensure that they have the best cardiovascular health.
Julie, from your perspective, what do you think about these modifiable risk factors? Are they implementable in real life?
Well, I mean, this is when we're talking about the American Heart Association, these are general for the general population and the importance of these eight areas. And I couldn't be more excited for sleep to be included in this discussion. When we're talking about people living with narcolepsy on a daily basis, I think it's important, first of all, to meet people where they are. And when you are extremely tired, and if you are experiencing cataplexy, which is a loss of muscle tone with emotions, and you start talking to me about a Mediterranean diet, you need to meet people where they are. And I think treatment, is really a first step. And then some lifestyle adjustments can be really important as well. Something I'm always a huge advocate of that is not talked about here is social support and the importance of connecting people with narcolepsy to other people. That can be life-changing. That can also help people to consider other things like other treatment options. It can help them think about lifestyle modifications. So really the first two things I would think about for a person with narcolepsy, if you are interacting with one as a doctor, is, some good treatment options for them and social support. And then lifestyle adjustments, I think, could be really wonderful if you're thinking long term. but remember to meet people where they are, because it's a lot to take on a new diagnosis of narcolepsy.
Very, very important points, Julie. When we just think of our patient, right, the example that we have, our patient says she's too tired to exercise. She wants to.
So, and that could be a real safety risk. You know, you have to remember people's safety. And so if someone's too tired or having cataplexy, that really needs to be addressed first before someone is told to be going to the gym every day to mitigate their symptoms somehow magically.
Yeah, these are really excellent points that we do need to tailor them and modify those for our patients with narcolepsy. And it will vary from patient to patient as well as to what they're going to be able to do and how we step it up and really be a tailored way. So let's get back now to our patient, Jennifer. Remember, she's the 26-year-old Hispanic female with a history of type 1 narcolepsy type 1, who has multiple comorbidities, including family history of hypertension. She herself has hypertension. So let's now try to apply what we've learned about the risk for cardiovascular disease risk and also some of our treatment modalities that we have available for our patients. And let's apply this to our patients. So I'd like to start by asking Paul if you can comment on that, and specifically now, how can we apply this knowledge? How would you approach our patient?
Yeah, well, obviously the first thing we want to do is to discuss with the patient her condition and tell her what we need to do as far as medication goes, or give her the options, rather, of medications. Those are very important because narcolepsy requires medications. If you can't do it as a primary care provider, then you obviously have to get a sleep specialist to do it. That's the first thing to do. And also, as Julie said, you know, get a support group would also be a very good idea. But then we just discussed all the cardiovascular risk factors. And this patient needs to know that it's not just narcolepsy, but we have to also discuss with her treatment options and lifestyle changes for her mood, for her blood pressure, maybe help her with her obesity. There's some wonderful options now that are available. So we want to treat the whole patient. And fortunately, in primary care, we get to see our patients very often, and we have multiple occasions where we can gradually instill these changes in our patients to have them to have the best lifestyle and the best treatment for the condition.
Julie, do you have anything to add to that?
Well, I think it should always be shared decision making between a patient and a doctor. And so, you know, I think it's just like I said before, it's a journey. So, you know, working on these things over time is important. I think that it's just always going to be a case by case and finding what works for each individual and giving each treatment enough time also to see, because sometimes side effects can present initially and then decrease over time, or you can make tweaks to the dosing. So there's just so much more to it in reality to find the right treatment approach that's going to work for you.
Yeah, even I, at least from my experience, even just how you dose the medication is really so dependent, not only the choice of medication, but dosing is really dependent on what is important to the patient, right? What kind of work do they do? What is their lifestyle and their social structure? All of these are really important considerations. So thank you, Julie. That's a very, very important perspective. So we have talked a good deal about the treatments and the treatments that can adversely affect cardiovascular disease risk, and those are a little bit more neutral. But we haven't really looked at the data itself to support some of the things that we've been talking about. So now let's take a little closer look at some of the safety data behind some of these different treatments that we just discussed. So Paul, would you like to lead us a little bit into this discussion?
Yeah, sure. So far we've talked about modafinil and armodafinil, and there's data on this that suggests that we do have to have a certain degree of attention and carefulness when we prescribe to our patients, especially in consideration of cardiovascular disease. So we can see it, for example, in this 40-week trial, there were some cardiovascular events, including palpitations, hypertension, tachycardia. There was also three serious cardiovascular adverse events which occurred: pulmonary embolism, heart attack, chest pain. There was some prolongation of QT interval, and there was three had QTC that were greater than 60 milliseconds. So we have to be aware that cardiovascular issues may arise in our patients that are taking these medications. Second is solriamfetol. In the 12-week trial, there was actually a mean systolic blood pressure increase from baseline, from the 75 milligram all the way up to the 300 milligram doses, respectively. You can see the numbers there. There was also an increase in the heart rate, as you can see with the numbers that are on this slide. There was no increase in non-dipping hypertension. I guess that's nice to see. And there was minimal risk of QTC prolongation. But again, we have to be aware and cognizant about blood pressure and heart rate with solriamfetol. Now, with pitolisant, the analysis showed no significant changes in blood pressure or heart rate, and that was really nice to know. And in the 12-week trial, the mean change in QTC interval from baseline was a little bit greater, as you can see with the numbers there. Three patients had post-baseline increases of greater than 60 milliseconds, and none had more than 500 milliseconds. Cardiovascular events, again, with heart rate, there's a specific number increase, right bundle branch block, sinus tachycardia, and palpitations. So again, what this says in these three medications, we do have to be aware about cardiovascular risk and follow our patients, take their blood pressures when they come in. Sometimes we have to do an EKG. You certainly have to listen to their heart and do an auscultation. So these are the things that we need to be aware of with these three medications.
So Paul, do you get an EKG prior to starting a patient on pitolisant?
In patients that I'm prescribing pitolisant or really any of these three medications, if there's any concern that I have of cardiovascular risk, I will do a cardiovascular workup, including an EKG.
Right. Thank you. One topic we have discussed is to decrease cardiovascular disease risk by decreasing sodium in our diet. Now, patients with higher sodium intake, we know, have higher risk of cardiovascular disease, including hypertension. We have discussed how to decrease cardiovascular disease risk by decreasing sodium intake. Patients with higher sodium intake, we know, have a higher risk for cardiovascular disease risk, including hypertension. This study aimed to determine whether patients who start on sodium oxybate have a higher risk for hypertension. Paul, do you want to describe the study for us?
Yeah, sure. So in these patients, and it was a claims data analysis of, from 2014 to 2020, with 954 patients taking sodium oxybate versus 1,906 controls. And the endpoints were composite of new onset hypertension diagnosis or initiation of antihypertensive medication. The second endpoint was new onset hypertension diagnosis alone. As you can see in the table on the right-hand side, the odds ratios were higher for developing new onset hypertension and initiation of antihypertensive medicine, as you can see on the table there. In the endpoint number two, again, the odds ratio is higher. So it does suggest that patients taking oxybate, sodium oxybate, have a higher probability of developing hypertension or needing to initiate hypertensive medication.
Which I think is a really important study, because I used to always think, well, we know there's an association, right, between high sodium intake and cardiovascular disease risk, but here it shows that those individuals who started on sodium oxybate had a higher prevalence of hypertension. So I think this is really important. Since high sodium can potentially increase CV risk in patients, then it does make sense that we'd want to decrease sodium intake, both in the diet, but also in the medications. We have here a real world example study of patients who are transitioning from sodium oxybate to lower sodium oxybate. Paul, what happened in this study?
Yeah, so this is a really promising kind of a study because we have sodium oxybate, which has been doing very well in treating our patients with narcolepsy. And now we have low sodium oxybate, which seems really attractive because it has substantially less sodium than the original sodium oxybate. So we want our patients to have the best cardiovascular situation, including low sodium. So what does this study tell us? It tells us that in this specifically 85 patients, with 45 of them with type 1 narcolepsy, 40 of them with type 2 narcolepsy, median age of 40, 73% women, and mean time of sodium oxybate usage was 58 months or so. And look at the findings. 84% noted that when we switched them, when they switched them from sodium oxybate to low sodium oxybate, it was extremely easy and not difficult at all, or it was easy. 95% stated the lower sodium content as a reason for switching. So even they knew that the low sodium was a healthier situation for them. 46% stated lower cardiovascular risk as a reason for switching. Now, there was minimal mean changes in the treatment satisfaction questionnaire for medication scores for global satisfaction and the satisfaction with effectiveness, side effects, or convenience after transition. So in this study, patients transitioning did very well and seemed to have a lot of motivation to transition from the regular oxybate to the low sodium oxybate.
Yeah, absolutely. I think, you know, all of this is not a control study. It is kind of a real world study. It's quite encouraging that, you know, these results are quite encouraging. And certainly for those of us in practice as to what we might expect, you know, from our patients as we consider either switching and or adding certain types of medications to their regimen. Let's finish our program with a final discussion about our patient and how we can apply the knowledge that we have discussed in optimizing treatment for Jennifer. Paul, can you give us some final take-home messages?
Sure. So Jennifer obviously is a patient that we will see in primary care as a person who has narcolepsy, who's been diagnosed by a sleep center, and the primary care provider, such as myself, knows and thinks that the sleep center has given information and has started treatment. But as a primary care provider, there's plenty you need to do. First of all, you need to make sure that the patient does have all the information they need about narcolepsy, what it is, why it happened, and what they also need to do to relieve the symptom of the tiredness that they have. You know, are they compliant with the medication, whether it's oxybate, low dose or low sodium oxybate, whatever it is. We need to make sure that they're ensuring adherence to medication. We need to make sure that they're safe. So we need to talk to them about safety, about what they're driving, if they're safe, or whatever occupations that they have. Are they doing okay in their family situation, social situation? So these things have to be taken into consideration. That's what we do in primary care when we deal with our patients. But also, this patient poses some specific important issues. She has obesity, she has hypertension, she has depression, all commonly seen in patients with narcolepsy. And it's up to us to help with those things with our patient. So whether it's the obesity and discussing, let's say, newer medications or lifestyle changes in diet and exercise, whether it's depression and treating with antidepressants, venlafaxine is a good choice for her because it also helps with some of the narcolepsy mm-hmm. symptoms, or whether it's with hypertension, where the low sodium oxybate is going to be a better choice. So there's a lot to think about, a lot to do, and a lot of information to pass on. And again, fortunately for these patients, they see us on many occasions as primary care providers, all those giving us instances to touch on all these situations and making sure ensuring that each one is being managed properly.
Thank you, Paul. Carl, what are some of your final thoughts?
So today we've been discussing a number of medications which are really effective for the treatment of narcolepsy. We are living at a time when we're blessed by the fact that we have a number of medication choices. Which we can use for patients with narcolepsy so that we can tailor the medication to the specific needs of our patients. In the case of Jennifer, of course, her specific issues had to do more with the background of cardiovascular as well as psychiatric abnormalities. And it's good to know that we have medications which are probably a bit more suited for patients like Jennifer, which do not have a burden, which do not increase cardiovascular burden, and which may be also protected against future cardiovascular risk. I also want to mention that in the case of Jennifer and other narcoleptic agents, we've been talking about pharmacology, but there are a number of other things which we could be doing non-pharmacologically to help these patients in conjunction with our pharmacologic strategies. For example, stressing that they obtain adequate amounts of sleep and that they employ judicious napping during the course of the day, which could decrease the need for medication by taking away some sleep burden. In addition, adhering to proper regular bedtimes so the circadian activity is not disrupted. And of course, proper exposure to bright light during the day and dimness of light in the afternoon or evening hours. Regular exercise should also be stressed for narcoleptics because not only could it be helpful in terms of reduction of blood pressure and long-term cardiovascular health, but also could be helpful in terms of alertness and activation. And finally, avoiding compounds that are sedating, such as alcohol and agents that are sedating in nature that are given medically. And of course, for those purposes, we should carefully examine the patient's cadre of medications to make sure that they're not sedating. So those are my comments in terms of that question.
Julie, what are your thoughts?
Yeah, I think this person is in a difficult situation. My heart goes out to Jennifer or to all patients or people living with narcolepsy being diagnosed in your late 20s. And she's in a difficult situation. She has other health considerations as well. And so I just, want to continue to point out the importance of social support because people with narcolepsy go back to their lives and might not know anyone else living with the same condition. So when you're talking about treatment options and lifestyle changes, I think research does show that people do better making lifestyle changes when they have community and support. So I don't think of that as an afterthought. I don't think of it as a nice to have. It is a must have. You need to be asking your patients, do they know other people with narcolepsy? Connect them to organizations and support groups and get them a part of the community, because education can happen in a primary care setting. It can happen at a sleep center. It can happen with other people living with the same condition to offer and organizations offer education and support year round. So, I just think it's a difficult case, but this person, I think, will do well over time with a lot of patience and dedication.
Excellent. Thank you so much. This issue of, that you bring up is really important as social support, but also education. Many of us, even myself as a clinician, we may not be thinking always about giving that information to our patients. Can you tell us a little bit more about how we can help our patients get better educated, but also get them the social support that they need?
Yeah, there are terrific organizations. So I run one called Project Sleep, but there's also Narcolepsy Network, there's Wake Up Narcolepsy, and there's the Hypersomnia Foundation. And those are often really great places to start. Those are all nonprofit organizations in the U.S. that do incredible education, both online, in-person events, and they have all sorts of different educational materials. We do toolkits. We have podcast episodes for addressing everything from your relationships with your friends and family to things like coping with cataplexy, to understanding what type 2 versus type 1 narcolepsy is. So there's just a lot out there. And when physicians can help connect people to our community, I think it's just everyone wins.
Great, thank you. My take-home message for me was that I am going to make sure that I look at cardiovascular disease risks, I look at their cholesterol levels, get their blood pressure measurements at every visit that I possibly can, and modify my treatment approach accordingly and try to really mitigate or decrease that long-term risk, because this is indeed a chronic disorder. So thank you. This was really an excellent program. And thank you, Dr. Carl Dogramji, Dr. Paul Dogramji, and Julie Fleiger for really this superb discussion. Now let's summarize our discussion with our SMART goals, which is specific, measurable, attainable, relevant, and timely. That is what I hope that you will take from this presentation to apply to your practice. Consider the cardiovascular risk associated with narcolepsy when either initiating the treatment plan for your patients and or optimizing their treatment plan. Recognize the potential cardiovascular impact specific to each treatment for narcolepsy, in particular, the pharmacological agents that we commonly use. And as Julie said, it is a shared decision-making process with your patient. So optimize patient treatment by considering the whole patient, tailoring the treatments for an individual patient, and consider the factors that can increase some of the medical and psychiatric comorbidities, including cardiovascular disease risk, but also I think very importantly, thinking about the entire well-being of our patients. Today's CME briefcase is part of a three-part series of case-based activities that can be found on the Sleep Disorders Hub. I hope you'll check these other two activities in the series. The Sleep Disorders Hub has these activities and many others on narcolepsy and more. CME Outfitters also has a Sleep Disorders Hub with a number of excellent resources to share with your patients. Thank you again, Dr. Carl Dragramji, Paul Dragramji, and Julie Fleiger for joining me today. And thank you for the audience for joining us. Be safe and take care of yourselves. And I really do hope that this discussion will help you optimize treatment for your patients.